Catalonia to Madrid. Can we talk today on The World? I'm Marco Werman. A special election in Catalonia did not clarify the Spanish region's future, but for Catalans who want independence, they've got a simple message for Spain's central government.
We don't really want to have a disruptive breakup. We don't want to create havoc in the market. We don't want to have a war. We've insisted on not being violent. So just talk to us.
Plus, the Trump administration adds another wrinkle for some airline passengers heading out of the U.S., face scans.
There definitely seems to be an appetite to roll this out in a much bigger way, you know, for really all passengers that are trying to embark on an international journey.
Those stories and more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for tuning in this Friday, the last workday before Christmas, which might well mean that you're traveling now or will be in the next couple of days. And if you happen to be flying out of the country through certain U.S. airports, you may encounter yet another new security check, a face scan. In fact, you may already have been scanned and didn't even know it. That's what happened to Tanvi Misra recently. She told me this story about what happened while she was heading to her gate at Washington Dulles to catch a flight to India.
What I thought was actually just a machine that was scanning, supposed to scan my boarding pass, was actually a facial recognition machine. And, you know, I was a little bit confused because there was really no communication about what this was. You know, there wasn't an announcement. There was nothing that the airlines had told us before. So I asked the TSA agent, I was like, what is this? And I didn't really get a response from him. Instead, I was told to, you know, just stand here and look ahead, just like all the other passengers had done before me. And because I'm not a U.S. citizen, I really didn't want to confront him or push back. So I went ahead and did what he said. And later, when I was walking through the gate and someone was, you know, tearing my boarding pass, I asked the ground staff, I was like, so what was that? And they were just like, oh, right, that was facial recognition, very, you know, sort of nonchalantly. No one else at the time really had any more information to give me. And so, you know, it was quite a surprise that that kind of process had been taking place without much communication about what it was or, you know, what options I had to opt out or not opt out.
Tanvi Misra in New Delhi with her story about her first encounter with a facial recognition machine recently here in the U.S. Misra is a journalist with CityLab here in the States and has written about this experience. As it turns out, the facial scanning technology is part of a pilot program being tested in 9 airports in the U.S., including right here in Boston. The idea is to make sure that people boarding international flights are the same people shown in their passports. Misra says using the technology for flights out of the U.S. has been talked about for a long time, but she says the Trump administration has fast-tracked it.
The DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Customs and Border Protection officials argue that this is going to make the boarding process a lot more efficient. You know, you're going to have a better check of visa overstays and potentially of document fraud of people who are leaving the country or intending to leave the country. But what the critics say is there are a lot of issues when it comes to how this thing works. There seem to be a lot of inaccuracies, and there is an accusation of racial bias. So those are some of the concerns that privacy experts have been raising.
Yeah, not just charges of racial bias, but also that these facial scans often pull out people of color and women. Why is that?
Right. The algorithms that sort of identify your facial features and are able to tell, oh, okay, this person's face is the same as that person's face in an image, don't work that well on, you know, people with darker skin and people with certain sorts of features. So you might have, for example, in this case, people of color being disproportionately affected by false positives. You know, they might not match up. They might have to be detained for longer because this machine is just not really able to accurately detect their face.
Let's talk briefly about some of the big privacy issues here, because the Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology found that these scans are happening routinely without any attention to federal law or privacy rights. Can facial scanning at airports legally happen without some oversight or public discussion?
There's some sort of murky legal issues when it comes to rolling this out. The first is that Congress hasn't authorized explicitly that these scans can take place on U.S. citizens. It has asked for these scans to take place on non-citizens, but not really on U.S. citizens. So, you know, there is the question of whether this is an overreach. That is one legal issue. The second is that the rulemaking process that is supposed to take place before something like this is implemented has not really taken place at this moment. And this is incredibly important because when there aren't any rules to dictate how these scans are being carried out, under what circumstances, and in what way this information is being used, there is a potential for abuse and a potential for sort of an expanded privacy violation.
Tanvi, have you asked Customs and Border Protection what they do with the data at these 9 airports? How is it being used?
What they said was that, at least as far as this pilot is concerned, this information is only being used to check the identities of the travelers. And they assured me that the technology is quite accurate. They said that it is a 90 percentile match rate, and that at this moment, at least, U.S. citizens can opt out of this process.
Yeah, just on that point, maybe you can give us a little help for this busy holiday travel week, because many of us are wondering what our legal rights are. So you were not given the option to opt out. I mean, can anyone opt out?
Right. So it seems that for non-citizens, we don't really have much of an option. This is mandatory, you know, if you take that particular airline at that particular airport. However, U.S. citizens who are concerned with this can bring this up to the officer in charge. And in the case that that happens, there might be an alternative. Whether that remains an option in sort of whatever expanded version of this program, the DHS is unclear at the moment, but there definitely seems to be an appetite to roll this out in a much bigger way, you know, for really all passengers that are trying to embark on an international journey.
Tanvi Misra, a staff writer for CityLab covering urban demographics, inequality, and culture, speaking with us from New Delhi. Thank you very much, Tanvi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yesterday was another bad day, capping a difficult year for Spain's Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy. Rajoy's government called new elections for the independence-seeking region of Catalonia after it voted to secede from Spain in October. Madrid refused to recognize the October results, so it dissolved the Catalan parliament, it chased the Catalan president into exile, and it threatened to charge independistas with rebellion and sedition. Well, those fresh elections were held yesterday, and it seems the 3 separatist parties have won again. Liz Castro is an American author who's lived in Catalonia on and off for 30 years. She's an active supporter of independence, and I asked her about the mood today in Barcelona.
I would say it's jubilant. We have insisted on using democracy to express our voices. And time and time again, we say, we really want independence. You can listen to us now. Come to the negotiating table. Spain continues to say, no, 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 we'll never listen to you. We're gonna charge you with sedition for having peaceful demonstrations. Kind of ridiculous. So people are pretty happy that, you know, even in these crazy conditions where the Spanish government dissolved our democratically elected parliament, deposed our president. It doesn't have the power to do that. It completely overstepped its boundaries. But even under those conditions, we still won. We still won because Catalans won independence.
But this victory was not by the margin you wanted, right? And I mean, in fact, while the 3 separatist parties got a majority of the seats in parliament, they didn't win the popular vote. Is it fair to say, Liz, that some Catalans are getting cold feet maybe about defying Madrid?
No, I don't think so. No, you know, we had more yes votes or votes for pro-independence parties yesterday than we did in the earlier elections. And so, you know, I think on the contrary, not cold feet, people are insisting, we want you to listen to us. This is what we're trying to tell you. And, you know, it'll be up to Spain to decide whether it's going to listen or whether, you know, it's going to create this instability across Europe by creating a problem where really there wasn't one. We need to be negotiating here. They need not to be turning a deaf ear to us.
Those negotiations, I want to be kind of tricky with the largest party now in the Catalan parliament, the Citizens Party. They want to stay part of Spain. So, I mean, the dream of independence still has some air in it, if I am hearing you right. But doesn't this feel like air is leaking pretty rapidly?
It doesn't. You know, there are seven parties in the Catalan parliament. The Ciutadans or Citizens Party is just one of those. So the fact that it won 25% of the vote isn't, you know, enough for it to form a government. On contrast, the pro-independence parties did win a clear majority in the Catalan parliament. This is a movement that has a breadth of support among the people, that there's one, you know, unionist party that gathered 25% of the vote. Okay, sure. There are people that still want to be part of Spain, but the majority voted in favor of pro-independence parties.
So, Liz, what do you see happening next?
Well, what I'd like to see happening next is for Spain to open negotiations to call off the judicial threats and charges against our political leaders. Yesterday, there was a report published by the Guardia Civil. This is a legal document that was giving the grounds for rebellion and sedition. These are crimes that carry 30-year jail sentences. And that document said that our peaceful demonstrations were rebellious and seditious acts. I think that's abominable. How can it be that in a 21st century democracy, they could consider a peaceful, nonviolent, cheerful demonstration as a seditious act? It's not. It's democracy. You're allowed to mobilize and try to change your government peacefully. That's the whole point of democracy.
Tell us a bit about your own stake in this fight, Liz, because you might be in trouble with the law yourself, right?
In fact, I am in that document. It's a little bit worrisome. They mention that even Liz Castro, the former international chairperson of the Catalan National Assembly, stated, and then they quote this speech that I gave at the 2015 Catalan National Day March, in which I quote Jefferson. You know, Jefferson's words in the United States Declaration of Independence when he says, when it becomes time to loosen the binds that link one country with another. That's not sedition.
I mean, it may not be sedition, but it is hugely provocative to Madrid, you have to recognize, just like Jefferson was hugely provocative to the King of England.
Having a demonstration, having multiple demonstrations with more than a million people year after year after year for 6 years in a row is not a provocation. It's a declaration of a desire to form their own country, to say, look, we are a people and we have a right to self-determination. We would like to negotiate it with you. We don't really want to have a disruptive breakup. We don't want to create havoc in the market. We don't want to have a war. We've insisted on not being violent. So just talk to us. You know, that's reasonable.
If the regional prime minister, Carlos Puigdemont, decides to avoid possible arrest and stays in Belgium, can any independence movement thrive without a leader on site?
Well, it seems to me that the Spanish government needs to recognize the results of these elections that it called illegally. And if the Catalan president, Puigdemont, won those elections, then he needs to be able to return to this country without being put in jail. The fact that the vice president is in jail right now is a travesty. They said that he's in jail for fulfilling his democratic mandate for holding a referendum. It's not illegal, even in Spain, to hold a referendum. And it's certainly not grounds for holding somebody in preventative custody before even having a trial. That's outrageous.
Yeah,
that's,
but Madrid's argument, as you know, is that these actions are unconstitutional.
That is Madrid's argument, yes. And at some point or another, Madrid is going to have to listen to the people of Catalonia because we're not going to be silent. Madrid says, yes, all you have to do is change the constitution, except that requires majorities that Catalans, as a 16% of the population, could never, ever, ever mathematically hope to achieve. It's simply impossible. Therefore, what we need is a political solution. We need the government of Madrid to say, oh, I guess there's a problem. Gee, look, there are a million people out on the streets 6 years in a row. They've voted three times in a row in favor of pro-independence forces. I wonder if something's going on here. Maybe we should talk to them. And that's what Spain has refused to do. Instead, it's doubling down and being absolutely authoritarian. Putting people in jail for having a demonstration is not okay. It's not democratic.
Author and Catalonia independence activist Liz Castro in Barcelona. Liz, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. When you think of great Western art, a few cities come to mind: Paris, New York, Florence. Outside the museums of Florence, tourists line up for hours to view some of the masters.
Michelangelo, Botticelli, Raphael, Leonardo da Vinci.
Bernini, if he's here.
But notice something about those names. All men.
I'll be honest, I'm not sure I could name a female artist from Renaissance Florence.
No, I don't think I could, but I will be interested. Who would you recommend?
Well, one of Florence's museums has some ideas. This year, the Uffizi kicked off a series of exhibitions dedicated to the work of female artists from centuries ago. And the curators didn't have to look far to find the artwork. Here's reporter Anna Benstead.
Deep inside the Uffizi, in an office dominated by a somber portrait of one of his predecessors, I meet the museum's current and very busy director, Ike Schmidt.
Hello, how do you do?
Well, thank you.
Schmidt took over at the Uffizi after some years at the Minneapolis Institute of Art, a place where he got some advice from an unusual source.
When I was in Minneapolis, before I became the director of the Uffizi, in fact, I met with the Gorilla Girls.
Feminist art activists who wear gorilla masks as part of their protest.
The Gorilla Girls told me that in many museums, in fact, women artists were in storage.
I think there was the general assumption at the time that if there were no women or artists of color in the mainstream art history books, it meant that their work did not rise to the quality necessary. Well, we knew that wasn't true. We knew that history is a richer story than that.
So I thought, well, when I get to Florence, let's have a look. What we discover is that we really are probably the museum with the largest collection of works of art by women before the 19th century.
But not necessarily on display.
I mean, I think nobody consciously decided, well, let's just put all the paintings by women into storage. But it was just a general prejudice that people held. And so it built up over time that male artists were privileged in museum displays.
Schmidt decided to get as many of these paintings out of storage as possible. So far this year, the Uffizi has already placed dozens of self-portraits by women on display.
We also will be hosting special exhibitions dedicated to women artists every March on the occasion of International Women's Day.
But it's not just one museum spurring change in Florence. Across town, which in Florence sometimes means crossing paths with a parade or a demonstration, Linda Falcone tells me about the Advancing Women Artists Foundation, where she's director. The focus is
art by women and how to rescue their stories and restore their work.
Falcone says when they first started approaching museums in Florence 10 years ago,
the first question when we would go in and say we'd like to fund the restoration of art by women, the response would be, why?
What was your answer to them?
I'm still answering. It's important to explain to people that women have, in fact, been forgotten by history. Women artists in their time were very, very successful. They usually enjoyed huge renown from their contemporaries, and that's something we forget.
There are some well-known women artists from Europe's past, like Artemisia Gentileschi, but the search is now on for the many others who have become invisible over the centuries.
In order to exist as a professional women artist, they had to be successful in their era.
Artists like Plautilla Nelly, the first to be featured as part of the Uffizi's new focus on women artists of the past. She was a 16th century painter, a nun who was as ambitious in her art as her male contemporaries.
She had a workshop where she trained other women. She did large-scale works, and that's a really important issue to look at, because most women artists of the 1500s were doing small-scale works. And then you have Nelly, who's doing these large-scale, enormous biblical paintings, like The Last Supper, which is 21 feet long.
And Falcone points out that Nelly was a self-taught artist. She had to be.
You have to consider a context in which women artists were not able to study. They couldn't frequent academies as full-fledged members, for example. They couldn't study anatomy. And they couldn't issue invoices for their works.
Back at the Uffizi, I have a question for Ike Schmidt.
In the world of academics and art historians in the 21st century, does it cause tension? Does it cause a problem that women artists are being displayed because they're women?
Well, I hope that it's not just because they're women. I mean, it's really, we're bringing them out, but we display them not in a separate space, so we don't create a feminine ghetto or anything like that.
And are those who wait so long outside the museum making time for the female artists of the past?
The visitors don't rush through, but they actually stay and look.
And a sure sign of success.
And take their selfies.
For the World, Anna Benstead, Florence, Italy.
Glögg. It's kind of fun just to say that word. Try it. Glögg. And I hear it's fun to drink glögg as well. It's kind of a spiced hot wine that's a holiday tradition in southern Sweden. My BBC colleague, Maddie Savage, got invited to a glögg fest recently.
The most important thing to remember before heading to any Swedish party is to buy your alcohol in advance. It's only available at Systembolaget, the country's state-regulated monopoly, and that's closed after 6 or 7pm and on Sundays. City dwellers here in Sweden love to head somewhere quieter during holiday periods, and around half the population has access to a country retreat through family or friends. I'm being hosted by Daniel Vergin, who's holding a small gathering a couple of hours' drive south of Stockholm.
Welcome to Smedsbo.
So, Daniel, we're in your really cosy home now in the middle of the forest, surrounded by a fresh dusting of snow. And you've got some glögg on the go. Tell us exactly what it is. We're by the oven now.
Yeah, this is a hot wine with spices, which usually are enjoyed with raisins and almonds. This is a white kind, and there is also red.
Okay.
It smells good.
Thanks, Daniel. We'll try that in a minute. I'm going to come over and chat to a couple of more of these guests. Who are you guys?
Hi, I'm Jessica.
Hi, I'm Bjorn.
What do you eat alongside glögg?
Gingerbread is the perfect match. And dates, and some almonds maybe.
What else is typically Swedish when it comes to the winter holidays?
I would say the Christmas tree.
Yeah, I mean the Christmas tree here has actually been chopped down from the forest
that
we're surrounded by.
Yeah, I would say being outside. A lot of people going skiing.
It's going to be a lot of drinking, ice skating, that kind of stuff. And then hopefully a great New Year's party. Yeah, I really think, actually, that Swedes do the holidays the best.
Swedish glögg parties often happen during the afternoon. I mean, is the plan to get drunk or is it more savour the flavour?
I think it's more like aim for coziness. It's being calm. It's a bit of Christmas music.
So, Daniel, is the glögg ready?
Yes, it's ready. Now we're going to serve it. We poured it in little, really small couple cups.
It is small. It's about half the size of a British teacup.
Yeah, because it's quite strong. It's stronger than wine and also hot, so it gets to your head really fast, so you have to be careful.
And what do we say when we start the glögg in Sweden?
The BBC's Maddie Savage in southern Sweden. You're with the World. I'm Marco Werman. At immigration rallies around the country, some activists like to play traditional music from Mexico to go with their chants.
This music is powerful for movements and for breaking down walls and for building power.
Son Jarocho's journey from traditional music in Veracruz to protest music in America is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston.
Marco, I've never had a Christmas tree.
That's The World's Shirin Jafari. Shirin, why not?
I was raised in a Muslim family in Iran, and it was just never part of my upbringing. But this year, for the first time, I wondered, should I get a Christmas tree?
Yeah, and do you know why you want one this year?
Not really. And I have to say, what started as a simple question, should I get a Christmas tree or not, turned into a long soul-searching journey with so many twists and turns along the way. I got into questions about religion, identity, belonging, you know, all those easy themes.
All right, let's hear your story. Sounds like it could be a tough one.
For a lot of my immigrant friends, the question, should I get a Christmas tree or not, is an easy one to answer. Why not? Said one when I asked her why she gets a tree. It's fun. Another said she likes the smell. And if they have kids, the answer usually is the kids love it. None of them are Christian, and they, like me, moved to the US in their 20s. My friends aren't alone on this. A Pew Research survey from 4 years ago found that 8 out of 10 non-Christians in the US celebrate Christmas. For example, 73% of Hindus do.
Hello?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Priya Nagaraj grew up in India.
I came to this country 14 years back.
She and her husband are Hindus, not that religious.
We moved here with one kid.
Now they have two. Nagaraj was educated at a convent in India. Christmas has always been a part of her life. So when she moved to the U.S., bringing home a Christmas tree wasn't a big leap.
It was just a natural thing to decorate our house and get a very small Christmas tree which would fit into our apartment.
But as Nagaraj's kids got older, she says, they had questions.
Nobody else celebrates our festivals, and we are Hindus. We celebrate Hindu festivals. So how important is Christmas to us? But I think we've all settled with the fact that it's nice to celebrate whatever we can celebrate. So,
do you think for your kids, is this adding another layer to their identity? Or do you think there should be more emphasis on Hindu traditions, for example, or not?
I feel that pressure on myself. So I do a little bit more for Hindu festivals than I would have otherwise. I do have to stretch myself a little, take the time out, even if I'm working, to make the special food that is associated with that festival, or dress up in Indian clothes at home so that they know that it's a festive day.
Yeah, she does it because for Nagaraj, the holidays are a way to make memories as a family.
When we look back to our childhood, I think festivals are very important. They do stand out in our memory. You do remember, and you associate it with people and laughter and house full of guests or food or clothes. And these are markers in our memory.
The more people I talked to, the more I realized everyone had their own reasons for getting a tree. But I still wondered, why should I get one?
That's direct experience.
I like your dress. Mm-hmm.
I needed insight from people who know me better. So I called for an emergency meeting with a few of my colleagues.
Okay, why do you want to get a tree?
Yeah.
That, I feel like you guys are being harsh. It's a Christmas tree. Everybody should be allowed to have one if they want
one.
Yeah,
that's not harsh.
Two of my coworkers, who are Jewish, told me for them, getting a Christmas tree was out of the question. No way. Another colleague, Rupa Shanoy, said growing up in the States, her parents, from India, would get her one because they felt it was part of U.S. culture. They didn't want her to feel left out.
I will say, as an adult, I don't do it because it seems like people do feel like it's a Christian thing. So I want to be respectful of their religion. So if that is a religious symbol, then I don't want to be disrespectful to it. And so I won't do it now.
Afterwards, I debriefed with Mike Wilkins, our sound engineer who was raised in a Christian family.
As many people that were in this room, there were different opinions, from no tree at all to the biggest, most giantest. Go out.
He was right.
Give it a shot. If you like it, you like it. If you don't, you don't.
Okay, but what do I even look for in a tree?
Well, I think it's less about the technical facts about the tree. Like for me, as someone who's always gotten Christmas trees every year,
Lydia Jean Cott, another colleague, had some thoughts.
It's more like you go to the lot and then you look for a tree that kind of just like speaks to you and connects to you. If you're feeling kind of like scruffy and it's like your first Christmas tree ever that you're buying as an adult, let's say you might be looking for like a tree that's maybe like an underdog tree.
Which one of these is an underdog?
I would say if you're going to really go for it.
I dragged Nina Porzuki, one of my other colleagues, to a tree lot with me.
Like, look at that tiny, the first one we saw, holy moly.
There it was, my tiny, underperforming, weak tree. And I know what you're thinking.
I never thought it was such a bad little tree. It's not bad at all, really. Maybe it just needs a little love.
I took my tree home, placed it in warm water, added plant food. By now, I'd heard at least a dozen Christmas tree stories. Happy ones, some sad. But I also had my own. And here's the truth. I don't have a clear answer as to why I wanted a Christmas tree this year. But for now, I have a little tree at home. And it needs me as much as I need it. For the world, Shirin Jafari.
I totally didn't get choked up there, Marco.
Yeah, I'm working on not getting choked up either. Your own Charlie Brown Christmas.
Yeah. So I did get a tree, but I kept thinking about what Rupa Shenoy said.
That if the tree is a religious symbol, she doesn't want to be disrespectful?
Exactly. And of course, I have no intention of being disrespectful to any religion. And so I asked Matthew Bell, who does a lot of religion reporting for us, to take a look at that question. Is a Christmas tree a religious symbol?
The Christmas tree at Faneuil Hall Marketplace in downtown Boston is an 85-year-old, 12-ton Norwegian spruce that's more than 80 feet tall. It's actually from New York, but anyway. The question I have for folks here is this. When you look at a brightly decorated Christmas tree like this one, do you think of it as a religious symbol? It turns out most people, like Jyoti Davuluri from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, say not really.
I'm a Hindu, but when I see a Christmas tree, it's all about the festivity around the town. I really like it. And I have a Christmas tree at my home for my kids. They are born here, so they grew up with this culture and everything. So I want to keep that alive. And we have a Christmas presents just like every other house. I may not have the religious, you know, background, but I still see Christmas tree as such a nice festive thing, and I want to continue for my kids.
A lot of Christians I speak with say something similar. Yes, the Christmas tree has meaning, but it's not really about religion for them. But the thing about Christmas trees is, if you start to look at their long history, there's a great deal of religious significance attached to them. Carrie Noonan is a professor at Champlain College in Burlington, Vermont, and an expert on folklore and mythology. And yes, she's got a Christmas tree.
And I do see it as religious, but not in what we call a theological sense, but in a folk religious sense. Folk religion is all those beliefs and practices that exist alongside of the official religion.
So where do Christmas trees come from? Noonan says there's one legend that gives credit to Martin Luther. But she adds that something like our modern-day ritual involving Christmas trees goes way back before the Reformation.
The Romans, during Saturnalia, brought in leafy greens and boughs and decorated their homes. Saturnalia was their midwinter festival. We also have evidence of pre-Christians, pagans in Europe, worshiping in groves, you know, worshiping trees or worshiping their deities within groves.
And it makes practical sense, Noonan says. Why not bring some evergreens into your family's home during the darkest and coldest days of the year as a sign of hope? Well, at one time, right here in Massachusetts, the Puritans actually outlawed Christmas for a stretch, says Father James Bretzky. He's a Jesuit priest at Boston College.
In the Puritan approach to Christianity, it was rather severe. And so the idea then that we would celebrate Christmas with trees and ornaments and decorations and presents, that really was against a Puritan understanding of Christianity.
Obviously, that has changed. The Catholic Church started celebrating Christmas centuries ago. In 1982, John Paul II became the first pope to have a Christmas tree put up at the Vatican. Father Bretzky told his congregation last Sunday to embrace the whole Christmas ensemble, as he calls it.
I said, let's send out cards, let's get presents and wrapping in a special meal, because it really does, as this ensemble, celebrate Christ and at the same time celebrates our sense of family and community, and that is not a bad thing.
Bretzky, who's 65 and grew up outside of Milwaukee, says he never remembers a time when he didn't see a Christmas tree at church. The only controversy around trees that he can recall is when the idea of getting an artificial tree came up. And some people thought that was just wrong. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
We journalists meet and talk with a lot of incredible people. It's one of the great joys of our job. And sometimes we even end up becoming friends with them. I want to take a few minutes to tell you about one of those people. His name was Calestus Juma. He was born in a tiny village in Kenya and ended up teaching at Harvard just down the road from our studios. Professionally, he championed innovation and technology in Africa and beyond. But out of the classroom, he was also the spark plug in our Saturday pickup soccer games. Calestus died last week at the age of 64 of cancer. A few years back, I called Calestus about the death of another innovator, Steve Jobs. Calestus himself often told us he was one of the first people in Africa to use a Mac. Here's what he had to say about Steve Jobs' death.
The first thought that crossed my mind when I heard it was that his inner light has shone on almost every person I can think of. And that is not going to go away. He's opened people's eyes to the possibility of taking technologies that already exist and give them a new purpose.
You could easily say the same thing about Kolestas. He was a gifted scholar and networker, not to mention an incredibly charismatic guy. He advised African heads of state and founded the first all-African think tank on sustainable development. He wrote a book that helped inspire the UN Convention on Biodiversity, for which he served as the first director. All this from a man who grew up one of 14 kids in a village deep in rural Kenya.
One dirt road in, one dirt road out.
Ken Kobe taught school in Kolestas' town with the Peace Corps in the 1950s.
It was 80 miles from the nearest town of any consequence. No electricity, no running water, mostly mud housing. But my memory of it was a place where the importance of family was paramount, where value of education was very much appreciated.
Kolestas became a teacher, then a science journalist, and he earned a scholarship to the University of Sussex in the UK, where he got his PhD and found his passion for new technology.
Kolestas would see the potential in technological breakthroughs and connect the dots to translate its use in areas where it has not been connected. That was Kolestas' genius.
That's Emmanuel Achiampong, one of Kolestas' colleagues at Harvard. Among other things, he says Kolestas was among the first to ask how Kenyans could turn their cell phones into a banking tool.
Would there be some infrastructure whereby texting on a mobile phone, you could send money? And out of that came this idea of M-Pesa. So M-Pesa enables money to be sent via mobile phone to a recipient of a mobile phone when neither necessarily even have a bank account.
That innovation gave hundreds of millions of new people access to banking. It was just one way Kolestas saw how newcomers to technology could sometimes outpace the early adopters. And he'd tell his students stories about this sort of leapfrogging.
Kolestas was full of stories. To grow up in rural Africa is to be a storyteller. And no one told stories the way Kolestas did. And it was not just about stories of his life. When Kolestas gave a lecture, where he got his images and his animation and his illustrations from, it was a delight to see Kolestas' brain at work.
One classic classroom story began with a slide showing scrawny goats grazing in the Somali bush with big numbers painted on their sides.
The owners of the goats write the mobile phone numbers on their goats. So if you like the goat, you actually send the money to the owner straight away, and then you go and collect the goat. Or if the goat gets lost, you read the number, and then you just call the owner and say, I've got your goat.
Kolestas Juma himself there talking to a class in 2015. For me, the man was also a magician. On the soccer field with some of us from the world, he showed me, both of us middle-agers, how to watch, to stay in place, and wait for the ball to come to you. Then he'd snag it and pass it off to a striker for a score. In much the same way, he saw opportunity in things and places where others only saw poverty and despair. That's a priceless vision and lesson. The Kenyan government will be giving Kolestas Juma a state funeral early next year. So let's head into the holiday weekend with a look at a little musical instrument that's been showing up in some unexpected places here in the U.S., immigration protests and rallies all around the country. It's called the jarana, and it's one of the main instruments used in Son Jarocho. That's a musical style from the city of Veracruz in Mexico that mixes indigenous, Spanish, and African elements. It sounds kind of like this. Playing there is Yared Portillo, an immigration rights activist in Philadelphia. She's playing the jarana with some of her musician friends. Yared uses her jarana to help bring her community together and speak out against what she sees as injustice. So first off, Yared, just describe the jarana for us.
So the jarana is a small instrument. A lot of people compare it a lot to the ukulele and its size. It can actually vary. It can be pretty small, about the size of a ukulele, up to about the size of an average guitar, a little bit smaller. It's an 8-string instrument. Some have anywhere from 6 to 10 strings. The average is 8 strings.
Mm. And those 8 strings, are they all different strings, or is it like a mandolin where the strings are plucked in pairs?
So depending on how many strings it has, usually it has about 3 strings that are set in pairs and 2 strings that are apart but are actually the same note.
And how many jaranas do you personally own?
So I own 4 jaranas right now, which is more than I ever expected to, but you know how it goes.
Yeah, you get one and you can't stop. So I'm always fascinated by music, and I was just looking into the jarana. It was kind of based off of a 16th century Spanish guitar. So do you know how it made this leap from that to a musical instrument used at protests, like here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, so the history of the jarana is when it originated in Veracruz. Some people would say it was the music of protest. Other people would say, no, it was just a traditional music that people started to politicize, right? And jarana was around for a long time. Son Jarocho was around for a long time. It was played within the elders of the tradition, and it reached this time where it kind of started to fade out. And 20, 30 years ago, maybe a little more, it hit this resurgence where folks in Mexico, who at the time were very young, said, we're going to pick up this music of our elders again and start playing it. And in the process of the revival, it began to work its way up to a lot of Chicano communities here in the U.S. And it's been natural that it's also become a part of what we take out to protests, of music that we use to sing about our experiences and to kind of experience resistance.
Have you met any people who are unhappy that the jarana has taken on this kind of political kind of face?
Yeah, so I actually, right when I was starting to play Son Jarocho, I met a teacher. She was one of our dance teachers who said, you know, there's all these people unnecessarily politicizing the music. It's just the music. It's just a tradition. You don't have to say that it's used for resistance and for revolutions. But then as we study the music, as we trace back the history, whether you want to call it revolutionary, whether you want to call it radical, I think there's still something inspirational about the ways that it was a music that was bringing in indigenous and African traditions in a space that was saying you have to be European, and the way it managed to conserve and merge a lot of those sounds together. And so whether you want to call that radical or resistance, or whether you just want to call that something inspirational and powerful, I think is something personal for each person. And I do think I've taken it as something that is meant to build power for marginalized communities that did that, even if maybe it wasn't its intention.
And why do you think the tone, the sound of the jarana makes it a suitable one for kind of energizing crowds at protests?
So I do think, you know, the way the jarana sings is very, we'll say very, very alegre, very joyful. It's used in sad music as well, but I think there's something about the way it just livens up people and energy, right? You know, the jarana is typically played in the fandango, which is a celebration that's focused around improvising music and celebrating and playing together and just a group of people coming together and making music. And I think also the size of the jarana really lends itself to be brought out to actions and protests, right? Like, I can carry my big guitar that's almost as big as I am, or I can carry my small jarana that easily fits on my back but still plays loud and draws people in.
You know, the late Pete Seeger had inscribed on his banjo, "This machine surrounds hate and forces it to surrender." Is there a protest you were at, or even a moment when you were playing the jarana and you felt a similar sort of power?
You know, I think, so there's a family detention center right outside of Philadelphia in Berks County. It's called the Berks Family Detention Center. This detention center, basically, it's one of the 3 family detention centers in the whole country. It detains entire families who've been, you know, trying to migrate into the U.S. Most of them are seeking asylum. Mm. And we've gone out to that detention center a few times, had different actions, different demonstrations. And this example, I wasn't actually there, but a lot of the people in the workshops I run were. And they played a song called La Guacamaya, which has a chorus that says, you know, something like, Vuela, 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 vuela sin tardanza, mientras la vida es dura, lugar tiene la esperanza, which says, fly, 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 fly without delay, as long as life is hard, there's always room for hope. During that chorus, when people sing fly, it's common that the dancers are flying with their arms, kind of mimicking a bird. And while they were playing that song out at the family detention center, the families that were detained on the other side started flying like birds with their arms the way a dancer might. And so it was just kind of this moment of connection, especially as we were singing about flying and about being free and about having hope. So a lot of different actions at that family detention center for me have been the space that have said this music is powerful for movements and for breaking down walls and for building power.
Yared Portillo, really great to speak with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This version of La Guacamaya is performed by Los Pájaros del Alba. Our theme music, not performed on a jarana, but it certainly does give me some ideas. Our theme was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. You have a great holiday weekend, and see you back on Monday.
Public Radio International.